Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009 when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on, not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Pallas, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book Vultures Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Carson's Corner here on Blog Talk Radio and in conjunction with the CommonsProjectNetwork.com. My name is Bob Carson and it is August 6, 2015, 9:04 Mountain Time, or as I refer to it, Colorado Time. I am broadcasting from Denver, Colorado. I hope I'm coming out loud and clear. I'm actually broadcasting in a hotel room where the internet connection is not as strong as it would be had I been broadcasting from my home. So hopefully I'm coming out loud and clear, and that'll continue throughout the show. I'm going to bring on Christopher Allen Driscoll, Election Boycott Advocates member from Bettendorf, Iowa. Christopher, can you hear me loud and clear?
Yeah, coming in just like you were standing next to me almost.
Good.
Pretty good, pretty good. You don't seem to be hurting anybody being in a hotel room in Denver. I saw a couple of your pictures today on your on your Facebook page. Looks like a pretty nice little stay there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, you know, Denver is a complete change of atmosphere for me because, first of all, I flew out here on Saturday. And Tuesday. I'm sorry. And obviously, I'm from New Jersey, Central Jersey. So I come out here, and one thing that Denver is known for recently, fairly recently, is the legalization of marijuana. And so you could walk down the street and literally smell marijuana, which is totally legal. People here are you know, smoking it everywhere, and I don't seem to see people going crazy. I don't see madness around me. I don't see this society that people talk about once you legalize drugs. I do see, on the other hand, it's interesting to note that in Denver, apparently, according to sources that I've talked to, there has been an increase in homelessness since they legalized marijuana, where apparently, according to some sources, the city of Denver actually has a 30% increase in the homeless rate, and people attribute that to individuals coming here and looking to smoke marijuana, which is legal. I attribute it to capitalism. I think a lot of people, you know.
Yeah. I was thinking the whole time you were talking there that they've had a big uptick in tourism.
Yeah.
So this is just one small aspect of the big boom in tourism that they're experiencing there. I know I've got a nephew and a niece who recently took a trip there. And they deliberately drove there rather than to fly so that they could drive back with a few souvenirs.
Yeah.
Touristy souvenirs from Colorado. So, it seems to be attracting, it's like overnight given Colorado kind of an extra dimension to their state. How would you put it? Their state rep.
Well,
the reputation they have.
I got to tell you, it's from where I'm at now, I'm within walking distance of the Mile High Stadium, the baseball stadium and some other stadiums that the professional sports teams play at, and around this area, I mean the high rise apartments that they've really what we've called bouged the area up. I mean I can't imagine what it costs to live here, and even a hotel room, a relatively cheap hotel room, costs about $200. A night, and that's a cheap hotel room here around these parts. Now, normally we would go for 2 hours, but I scheduled the show for an hour and a half today because I have to literally wake up at the crack of dawn to go to work tomorrow, and so I'm working nonstop, almost 14 hours a day, and it's just the schedule has just been brutal. But nonetheless, it's been okay. It's been a pretty good experience. I'm glad that we're able to talk here on Thursday night. Last week we had Harry Kaysen on the program, and that show did very, very well. Here on Blog Talk Radio, and we move forward. We just move forward, a new day, and we're talking about the issues that really matter to the working class in America. So, with that said, Christopher, you've probably been following the news, the issues a lot more closely than I have over the last a week or so. So, anything that you want to start off that comes to mind?
Well, perhaps we should start off with a bit of a discussion about Iran and Barack Obama's Iran nuclear deal, so-called nuclear deal.
Sure.
That was suggested to us by our third partner, Thomas Baldwin, who's not with us so far tonight, but he did say that he would be listening in and that he would call if he felt as though he could contribute to anything. So we may get a call from our good buddy Thomas.
Good.
Sometime during the night. However, this was his suggestion that we... And lo and behold, it is going into the Congress for discussions. Recent news just today is that Senator Chuck Schumer, who's a notorious Zionist, we all know, a notorious supporter of the fascist occupiers of Palestine. I don't like to use that other name that they call themselves. I just call them the Zionists. But he is a strong Zionist, so it's not surprising that he has announced today that he will be voting against Obama's deal. And, I guess they so far, they only, in the Senate, they have like 12 confirmed Democrats who are going to vote in favor of the deal. The article I read didn't from the New York Times didn't say where Republicans are at. I imagine that there are some Republicans who will be voting with Obama on this one, and that a great majority of them will probably vote against it. They made a big deal, we recall a few months ago when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from occupied Palestine came to the United States and gave a speech before the joint session of Congress, which caused a lot of controversy because normally that kind of thing, I guess not even just normally, but always in during that kind of a situation where a foreign head of state comes or a foreign government leader comes
right.
to the United States to speak to the Congress, they normally go through the State Department and through the President's office to get a formal invitation to do so, but they didn't bother to do that. They kind of went above, they were going above Obama's head to Congress, which is kind of funny if you think about it, because Congress has literally emaciated itself and caused itself not to have the powers that the Constitution gives it. But in this case, they had Benny Netanyahu come and speak to them. And, of course, Benny Netanyahu's a number one priority objective in that was to oppose the deal. The deal hadn't even been agreed to at that time, but oppose the deal with Iran. Iran, of course, is eager to get sanctions lifted from it, economic sanctions,
right.
which have been, the United States has had economic sanctions on Iran continuously ever since the Islamic Revolution in 1979, and more recently the United Nations. When was that? 2011 or 2012, probably, the
right.
United Nations imposed severe sanctions on Iran. And in my opinion, the whole thing's trumped up to begin with, because Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program, never has.
Right.
Even the United States CIA admits that since 2003, they have not had a nuclear weapons program. But, I mean, you know, the founder of the Islamic Revolution, the Ayatollah Khomeini, was very clear on the subject. He said that a country possessing nuclear weapons was a sin against God, that's the way he put it, and that Iran would never, ever have a nuclear weapon. And the leadership since the Khomeini died in Iran has continued with that same official policy, that they will never, that they don't seek nuclear weapons, that they will never have a nuclear weapon, that they see it in religious terms as a terrible sin against their God. So, you know, I mean, the whole thing is kind of trumped up. I believe that Iran has been kind of playing a little game with the United States, because the U.S. sanctions against Iran have been going on against Iran a long time before this whole trumped up issue, this phony issue about nuclear weapons came up. And I think they were looking for a way to kind of up the ante to try to force the U.S.'s hand into coming up with some deal to lift the sanctions. And as part of that, you know, they deliberately, in my opinion, they deliberately began refining uranium, which... You know, I mean, you can say, as they do, that there are scientific reasons for that, and they do use the uranium for scientific research and so forth, for medicine, that kind of thing. However, you know, it's I believe it was part of their game was to try to force the United States to the negotiating table. So, from that point of view, I guess they won, because they did force the United States to the negotiating table over something that they didn't want anyway. They've never wanted a nuclear weapon.
That's true.
So it's kind of crazy if you think about it. On the other hand, we should point out that Iran's nuclear program has always been in accordance with international treaty on nuclear proliferation and on nuclear programs. They have never violated any of the treaties, any international law concerning nuclear weapons,
right,
or nuclear weapons research, or nuclear research in general. So they've always been in accordance. The most ironic aspect of this whole farce is the role that the Zionists in occupied Palestine play, because as we know, Israel, that word I can't stand using, Israel has, and it's been pretty well verified, they do have nuclear weapons in violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which they refused to sign. But frankly, whether they signed it or not, you know, the overwhelming majority of the countries in the world have signed it, and they are in violation of it by possessing nuclear weapons. So it's kind of an irony that Benjamin Netanyahu throws a big fuss, throws a big temper tantrum in the U.S. Congress over this, when what we should be doing is threatening to invade Netanyahu's dictatorship and overthrow the evil fascistic Zionists who run Palestine, who've you know, stolen Palestine from the Palestinian people, and to run it as a pretty gruesome fascistic dictatorship, where the life of the average Palestinian is not a hell of a lot better than the life of a slave.
Yeah.
Not a hell of a lot better than the life of in prison. I mean, if you look at Gaza is a, what is it, like 5 miles wide and 32 miles long, basically an open air prison. The people are stuck in there, and every time the Zionists get a wild hair up their wazoo, they start dropping bombs on people's houses.
You know, I remember years ago, I had, this is going back 4 years ago on the show, I had a lady named Audrey Bomsey on the show, and she's part of the Free Gaza movement. And I don't know if you remember this, but about 4 or 5 years ago, there was the issue of the flotillas being attacked, trying to...
Yes, I had a few friends on those flotillas, actually.
Yeah, and so I interviewed Audrey Bomsey, okay? And, you know, this was a peaceful effort, humanitarian effort, trying to give aid to the people of Palestine. And after that interview, I got an email from a guy named Mark Levine. He's he's one of these Fox News liberals. And he was, how dare you have her on? You're spreading anti-Israel hate. And I had him on the program for like an hour after that. And, you know,
Mark Levine.
Do you know who he is, by the way?
I've heard the name. I kind of have a picture in my mind of him.
Yeah, he's like I said, he's a Fox News playing the role of a liberal. I don't know if he's on Fox News anymore. I don't care. I haven't spoken to him in years, but I agree. The conditions, the blockade, the attacks into Palestine, the number of Palestinians dead. Ever since, I mean, if you go back to. I think it was 2005 or 2007 when Hamas was democratically elected. It would be considered an act of war by any rational standards. If something like that happened here in the United States, if our neighbor or you know however you want to frame it, were doing the things restricting food, restricting aid, attacking our citizens, we would consider.
And remember that the bombs that are falling on the Gazans are made in the USA.
That's true. That's a very, very good point. But going back to Iran, I absolutely agree with everything you were saying regarding the nuclear program, or not the nuclear, because there wasn't. They had enriched uranium programs that was under the law, international law. Inspections were carried out, and it just seems to me that President Obama came out today and said that. If you oppose this deal, you bring us closer to war. What about those that support this deal? How would that bring us closer to war? What is the motivation for the United States? Because the hypocrisy here is unbelievable. For some of the things that you mentioned, for the fact that the United States of America has been the only country to use a nuclear weapon, I believe, in the history of mankind.
You are correct.
What is the real motivation here? I mean, I know President Obama has political motivations for this.
Yeah,
but
I believe a lot of it has to do with an attempt to undermine Russia's position in the world. The United States for the last couple of years has been desperately looking for, and Europe, it's the U.S.'s junior partners in crime, have been looking for another source of oil and gas besides Russia. Russia, for instance, supplies one-third of the gas, the natural gas, to Europe. and Russia could cut that off at any time. They're not going to, because, you know, it's a source of great income to the Russian to the Russian government. But obviously, in a case of an escalation in the hostilities between NATO and the United States and Europe on the one hand, and Russia and its allies on the other, that oil could potentially stop flowing. Now, they're looking for a replacement for that. I think that that is a big motivation on the part of Washington, on the part of the Obama regime, and why the Obama regime has been so keen to make this deal. As I mentioned the last time we were speaking about this, I think it was a couple of weeks, like 2 weeks ago, we were talking about this issue, and I mentioned that other regimes, other governments that had made deals like this after being like on the outs with U.S. imperialism, they had made deals with U.S. imperialism. And except for the case of Syria, where Assad, President Assad, is hanging on by a thread, other than that case, these countries that have made these deals, their leaderships are dead. So, I mean,
right,
you
yeah.
look at, you know, I mentioned Muammar Gaddafi as one who made a deal with Bush in 2002 and was very helpful to Bush in helping to run down and track down Islamic terrorists. When Obama came in, he started an imperialist destruction, basically. So you can't even really call it a war. You know, Obama and his NATO and European allies pretty much went in and destroyed Libya. Libya had been the country with the highest per capita income in Africa, with the highest standard of living in Africa, a country where people enjoyed a lifestyle that few Americans enjoy. We've gone over the kind of social benefits of being in Gaddafi's Libya. I don't think it's going overboard to say that it was a workers' paradise. You know, I mean,
yeah.
It really was a wonderful place to live. You know, you get free housing when you get married. You get subsidized gasoline for your car, where gasoline costs a few pennies per gallon, basically, a few tens of cents. You get free education anywhere in the world you want to go, plus your living expenses while you're getting the education. So, I mean, if you get into Harvard, Libya paid for its citizens to go to Harvard. You get everybody in Libya got, they had a system that was very similar to the kind of system they have in Alaska, where every citizen gets
right.
you know, a check in the mail. That amounted to about $12,000 per family in Libya. And, I mean, you know, the cost of living in Libya was pretty low, so they have subsidized food where, you know, basically your food bill is, $20, $30, $40 a month.
Right.
So $12,000, you can live like a king
right.
in your free house.
Yeah.
You know, in your car with practically free gasoline. So Obama destroyed that. The Iranians have a social safety net that's pretty good as well, and I believe in the long run that Iran is still slated for execution, the entire country. And as we know, looking at Libya, the whole country of Libya basically has been executed. It's been turned into a failed state that's run by Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
What about
I'm sorry, Bob.
No, sorry. You know, the enriched uranium, and under this deal, most of their uranium capacity is going to be reduced, and after I think it's going to be reduced to something like under 4%, and the remaining uranium is going to be supposedly shipped to Russia, what about that? I mean, would that? To me, I'm skeptical as well. I don't. How can we at this point trust anything that this administration, or really any administration in the world of really? I mean, I trust very, very few governments. I mean, we saw what happened in Greece. We talked about this extensively on this program. Even a good sounding political party emerging out of several groups and sounding really, really anti-capitalist and really, really on the side of working people against austerity, they get railroaded by Cyprus turned out to be a sellout, and many in his party have sold out. And so it's just, to me, and I think a lot of election boycott advocates would agree, it's almost impossible to trust any government, any capitalist government, or you know, virtually any economic system in place. I just wonder if this extra uranium is going to really help Russia, who we've talked about on this program, is doing pretty well economically, is not struggling, despite what you hear in the Western media, and moving forward in opposition to the United States. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, I'm not sure. I have not read about or brought myself up to speed about this side of it. I mean, I knew about the overall details, like that Russia was going to take. And I believe that what this is essentially is Russia is taking control of the uranium, the refined materials. But they don't own the materials. In other words,
right,
they're holding it in escrow, essentially, for Iran, so that they have control over it, but Iran can use it. So as I said, it is used in medical, in medicine. It's used in scientific research and so forth. So they have legitimate reasons for using it. So that's my understanding, but I don't know exactly how that's going to work out. I mean, I don't think that Russia can just take hold of it and, you know, sell it for profit or anything like that. You know, any of our listeners can call in and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that it's kind of an escrow sort of situation. You know, the idea is that one of the nuclear big brothers, you know, that are more, quote, responsible, will have control over it on behalf of Iran. You know, and obviously it's not a big issue to Iran, the control of those materials. I think the bigger issue for Iran is, you know, trying to get out from under the U.S. and U.N. sanctions. And I think, you know, as I've said in the past, I think that's a mistake for Iran. I think that Iran should not be turning towards Europe. I think Iran should be, you know, getting closer to Russia and China.
and joining in the new economy that Russia and China are leading in creating. That's what I would do in that circumstance. I'm not an Iranian, so you know, it's obviously it's up to the Iranian people ultimately to decide. You know, they seem to feel, and I think that the Iranian government, which is relatively new, you know, there are, I think the Iranian government tends to side with the capitalist class in Iran, and they're looking at what's going to be in the best interests of the capitalist class. And of course, the capitalist class is very interested in trade with Europe. They're not just interested in the oil, which, you know, I mean, the oil is owned by the state anyway. They have totally nationalized system in Iran. So obviously the capitalist class is only indirectly going to benefit from sale of oil and gas. But in any kind of a situation like that, first of all, you have all the ancillary companies that feed into that industry that will also benefit from those kind of sales. And you have just in general the Iranian economy, which is pretty depressed. And they're looking for markets to pump up their economy, and they're hoping to open up European markets. That's what they're interested in. In the long run, I don't think that's going to help the people of Iran very much.
Yeah.
It'll help the rich people of Iran, but you know, we'll see.
Well, you know, I like to think of it as if there was a country that really posed a threat to everyone's existence, and they were really trying to acquire a nuclear weapon, I would think that the majority of nations, almost all nations, would come together and try to forge some sort of path in order to preserve, you know, mankind. And you look at our military action, or you look at our intervention overseas, which has been a complete disaster, really, in my lifetime and before that. And much of the international community is against our actions, is against, you know, our efforts. I mean, you know, when it comes to Iran, now, it, as you mentioned, the new government is definitely more pro-Western, certainly than was the case under Ahmadinejad. But it just seems that it's... if there really is a threat that arises, then the world will be pretty clear on, you know, trying to neutralize that threat and come together, you know, on a non, you know, violent course of action. And that's the thing with the United States and is that we always seem to be wrong in our interventions. We always seem to be wrong when it comes to, you know, who we support and who we don't support, and the proof is in the world opinion. The proof is in the world polarization, and something we've talked about extensively on this program. And so, I just think it's kind of unfortunate that we're in this situation now. But you know, it's these forces that you talk about, that we've talked about. It's the capitalist forces. It's their control over the media institutions. And, you know, I just finished my that book by Michael Parenti, Black Shirts and Red Shirts. And he talks about how this goes beyond an economic system. This is a social order that exists really all throughout the world, that is just, it's just spreading all throughout the world rapidly, where everything is altered. International relations is altered. Property relations is completely skewed.
Everything under the sun, under the social order. And I think that a lot of that applies to this situation as well, our relationship with other countries and how, you know, we selectively choose who we're going to target and who we're not going to target.
Yeah. Well, I've said for years that the United States' objective vis-a-vis Iran was to force Iran to submit to U.S. power, and I think that's what this deal really represents. It represents Iran finally saying uncle, basically, and saying, okay, look, we've wanted to be an independent country, an anti-imperialist country, a country that stood strongly against U.S. imperialism, and the United States has dished out a great amount of pain to our economy and to our people. We've got to remember that the United States was not only trying to harm Iran through sanctions, but also the United States has supported guerrilla forces that were fighting against the Iran. The Mujahideen, for instance, which is you can't really call it a Marxist organization anymore, but it started out 30, 40 years ago, 50, 60 years ago, I guess, as a Marxist religious organization, Marxist Islamic organization. They've lost most of their Marxism. They're just an Islamist organization now, and the United States has funded that organization with the purpose of fostering violence and sabotage inside the borders of Iran. So they've also done that. And I think that this represents Iran simply giving in and saying uncle, you know, pounding on the floor like they do in the wrestling rink. On the other hand, we've got to realize that there are different forces at work in Iran, and there are obviously some forces that are totally opposed to this deal. The government, which was just elected a couple of years ago, is in favor of this deal, but the Ayatollahs who run the state, who really have power over the military, most of them are opposed to it. We're going to see, I think, in the long run that it's going to be a situation like with Gaddafi. You know, Gaddafi gave in, he said uncle, you know, he made his deal, and then like 5-6 years later he started trying to reassert his independence. And like with his announcement the same year, 2011, the same year that Obama slaughtered Libya and murdered Gaddafi. Gaddafi had announced that that Libya was no longer going to accept U.S. dollars in payment for oil. Well, that kind of thing, that's a bridge too far for the United States, any kind of assertion of independence. So in the long run, we're going to see changes in government because, you know, Iran does have a kind of a democratic elections, basically, that allow the people to elect. And sometimes the people elect, you know, people who are more what they call liberal, which is actually very true about liberalism. They've now elected a more liberal government, meaning that it's a government that favors capitalism and capitalists. And on the other side, they used to have a president, I can never pronounce his name properly, Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad, who was more socialistic minded. So, you know, the government goes back and forth between those who are more socialist leaning, more working class leaning,
like Ahmadinejad, and those like the current president who are more capitalist leaning or more liberal, as they call them.
And that's how we control them. That's how we assert control, because these sanctions that are supposedly being lifted, they can go right back into place, and they will, if we don't like the government that they put in charge, regardless of their desire to produce a nuclear weapon. And that is exactly the point. We assert control. We'll have control over that country if they elect an Ahmadinejad. Then you know what? The sanctions go.
And Obama's spokesman said as much last week.
Right.
You know, Obama's spokesman was asked the question. He said, "Well, look, you know, military options are still on the table." Those are his words. If they start doing what we don't like, you know, obviously they go back to their military options. You mentioned Michael Parenti. Earlier today I was watching a couple of his speeches that he's given on a couple of his books that are about the subject of imperialism. And I hoped that tonight we could talk a little bit about imperialism in general terms.
Sure.
And I find Parenti, by the way, just phenomenal.
Yes.
He had a book out just a couple of years ago called The Face of Imperialism, where he talks basically about how imperialism operates, you know.
Right.
And I think that's one of his books that I'm going to try to get a hold of and try to read. But I watched couple of his speeches about that, and a couple of his old speeches also about his book Against Empire, which I believe came out in the 80s. And of course, not a lot has changed, because you know, we've got the same problem. The greatest threat in the world today, just as it was the greatest threat in the world in the 1980s, is U.S. imperialism. And I mean, the way the U.S. Imperialists operate, they control, in my estimation, about 140 countries are directly under their control, and several of these countries operate as kind of junior partners. You know, they're not. You look at Western European countries, for instance, Britain, France, and Germany, foremost, you know, along with Italy and Spain and so forth. They operate as kind of junior partners in imperialism, junior partners in crime, as I call it. There are a couple others like that. There's the whole Anglophile world, which includes Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Those countries all are also junior partners. They have a status above those of the rest of the countries, because the rest of the countries are basically satellites. You know, they're basically client states under the direct thumb. You know, and how do they keep control of that? Number one, they use their control over money, over banks, over the big banks, to make loans to these countries and then use that to exact tribute from these countries. That's one of their main ways of controlling them. But they also have real physical ways, like, for instance, the fact that the United States has more than 800 major U.S. Military bases on foreign soil spread around the world.
Right.
No, I mean, we should put that in context. No other country, no other empire in the history of the world has had anything close to that. The Roman Empire had nothing like 800 garrisons. You know, major garrisons spread around the Roman Empire. There was nothing like that. I mean, there were less than 100 major garrisons in the Roman Empire. The British Empire has never ever, and doesn't have today.
the British Empire has something like 30, military bases around the world right now. And at its height, it probably had a couple hundred, but not 800.
Well, you know what's funny? I was watching something. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I was watching something. Not only do we have these military bases all over the world, but you look at the creation of the CIA, you look during the Kennedy administration, the failed Bay of Pigs invasion. Exactly.
Right.
We have black op units all going all across the world at any time, at a moment's notice, intervening, going into other countries, committing assassinations, committing election rigging, all sorts of warfare, unconventional, unseen warfare that the United States government doesn't acknowledge exists, but we know, of course, this exists. And I was thinking to myself yesterday while I was watching this program on Netflix, could you imagine if Russia had a black ops unit that we later found out was deployed to the United States to conduct some sort of mission? I mean, could you imagine if any other nation the reaction in our media? It's just unbelievable, and yet this is going on all across, and this is part of the effort. This is all part of it's all part of imperialism. It's all part of war by other means, as Joe Lombardo from UNIC said at the Left Forum that I attended earlier this year. And so it's really, really astounding.
It really is. And, just get back to what I was talking about, they have many different measures,
yeah,
many different ways that they control all these countries around the world. And ultimately, and that's why I constantly, over the years, since this book came out, I've constantly recommended the book by John Perkins, called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, because he gets into the nitty-gritty of how this system works, about how they dole out billions of dollars, and then they encourage the local corrupt officials to skim off the top, to basically to steal parts, billions of dollars off the top of these loans and put them in their Swiss bank accounts, because that's a form of control, too. And ultimately, if the economic hitmen don't succeed in controlling a leader who is striking out in an independent way, they threaten, they use sabotage against the person, like they've been doing to Iran, and they threaten invasion. You know, I was just going, I have a friend who lives in Washington, D.C. His name is Bill Bloom. You're probably familiar with him. He writes this great column once a week about imperialism. And he's written several books about imperialism. He's an older guy. He's older than me. He was one of my union brothers in the National Writers Union. And he's got this list here. I just want to go over this list real quickly. Countries that the United States has either overthrown the government of, attempted to overthrow the government of, or invaded since World War II. China in 1949, and in the early 60s, which, of course, was a failed attempt because China's still standing. Albania, also 1949 to 53, also a failed attempt. East Germany in the 50s, also a failed attempt. Iran, 1953, the democratically elected government of Iran was overthrown by the CIA. Guatemala, 1954, also overthrown. Costa Rica in the mid-50s, they didn't succeed in that. Syria, which they're trying to overthrow now through jihadi proxies. They tried to overthrow the Syrian government in
56, 57, Egypt in 1957, back when Nasser was the elected president of Egypt, Indonesia in 57, 58, British Guiana in 53 through 64, and they succeeded in overthrowing the British Guianan government. Iraq in 1963, which, of course, you know, those who are familiar with the history of Iraq, Iraq had a democratic socialist revolution in 1958 and started, you know, going in the socialist direction. So the CIA found a young leader named Saddam Hussein and started paying Saddam Hussein. And in 1963, Saddam Hussein's forces succeeded in overthrowing the legally elected government of Iraq, and we know the history since then. So we can thank the CIA and the U.S. Imperialists for that. North Vietnam, of course, 1945 to 73, when they were not successful at that. Cambodia, once again, 1955 to 70, not successful. Laos, 1958, they were successful. 1959, again, they were successful. 1960, they were successful. Ecuador, successful in 1960 to 63. Congo, 1960, also successful. France, in 1965, people don't know about that. Brazil, 1962 to 64, which, of course, led to a military junta under the CIA thumb running Brazil. Dominican Republic, let me just go down the rest fast because there are so many of them. There's like 60 of them here. Cuba from 1959 to present, Bolivia, Indonesia, Ghana, Chile in 1973. We know about that one. That was successful, overthrew Allende. Greece in 1967, Costa Rica, 70-71, Bolivia, 71, Australia in 73 to 75, which was successful. They overthrew the Australian government, most people don't realize. Angola in 75, Zaire in 75, Portugal 74, 76, Jamaica in 79, 80, Chad, Grenada in the 80s, South Yemen in the 80s, Suriname, Fiji, Libya in the 80s, not successful, Nicaragua in the 80s, successful. Panama in the 80s, Bulgaria in 1990, Albania, Iraq in 1991, partially successful, Afghanistan, Somalia in 73, Somalia in 93, Yugoslavia, which was very successful for the imperialists, 1999 to 2000, Ecuador 2000, Afghanistan, Venezuela in 2002, not successful. Iraq in 2003, Haiti in 2004, Somalia 2007 to the present, Libya in 2011, which of course was successful, and Syria, which hasn't been successful. Oh my God,
yeah,
Bob, that's left my mouth tired from going through that.
And
that's,
you know,
that's what they do to control. And the most important point, which Parenti points out in his speeches, is these are all examples to all the others. The other 139 countries that are looking at Libya being destroyed, it's important. That's why I don't really agree with you that, you know, done the wrong thing. They've done the wrong thing from our perspective, from what we, the American citizens, would like to see. But from the perspective of the capitalist class, they've done the right thing.
Yeah.
They've done the thing that will scare the living bejesus out of all those other countries that the United States controls. It's like, you know, mess around and we'll be dealing with you next. We'll come and destroy your country.
And the real how they assert this control is the money that goes into these operations is not under public scrutiny. It's literally done in secret. And so
what do they call that? Black something?
Black ops.
Black ops. Yeah.
Yeah, it's literally done in secret. And so what happens is that, you know, while we focus on welfare spending, while we focus on the real you know, meager parts of our budget during the year, these imperialists who control the so-called defense industry, these private contractors that have really siphoned our tax dollars really over the last several decades, they get their money no matter what. And it's not right. up for public view. It's not up for debate whatsoever. And one thing that Bernie Sanders has said that he's absolutely correct on is that since the 1990s, we've seen a drastic increase in military spending, 2-3 times, 300-200% increase. In military spending, which tells you that this is going to continue no matter what, because it's what the capitalist system requires.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we look at it and we think, "Oh my God, Iraq, what a mess!" You know, but from the capitalist perspective, Iraq's not a mess; it's a big success. Because, right. first of all, job accomplished. I mean, you know, they needed to curtail the amount of oil coming out of Iraq, first of all, because they knew that the glut that would cause in the world markets, the oil profits would crash, they would fall, you know. So they use Iraq, and they've done this. I think I described this. There was a secret deal between Britain, the United States, and Saudi Arabia in 1926, where they would deliberately use Iraq to control how much oil was flowing out. Because there's so much oil in Iraq that if you depress the amount of oil coming out, obviously the prices around the world, the oil prices are going to go up and the profits are going to go up. That's the way right. it works. So from the capitalist perspective, number one, they sent a message because, you know, Iraq was basically a totally nationalized economy. They had basically a socialist economy, and it worked pretty well. I mean, they had an economy similar to what I described a few moments ago about Libya. You know, they had free education for everybody. Everybody had subsidized. There was a lot of bad things about Saddam. There's right. no doubt. You know, and people know all about it. And there was a lot of bad things about the way Saddam ran Iraq. But the citizens of Iraq lived pretty high on the hog. They lived pretty well up until the United States destroyed it.
Right.
That's the message. Then the message number one is socialism, even social democracy, is a no-no. You can't have that because it digs into profits to help workers,
right.
number one. And number two, if you strike out in, you know, independent direction and you don't do what the United States government tells you to do, we will destroy you. That's
yep.
the message. We will destroy you. We, you know, those people, the imperialists, they destroyed Iraq. They've destroyed Afghanistan. They've destroyed Libya. They destroyed Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia doesn't exist today as a country. It exists as a several, like 9 or 10 mini countries, several of which have fascist governments. I mean, I'm looking the other day. Have you ever looked at the flag of Croatia?
Not recently.
I think it's Croatia. Either Croatia or Slovenia, one of the two. The
right.
flag actually has a Nazi symbol in the flag. It's not the Nazi symbol that people mostly know. It's the Nazi symbol that the Yugoslav forces that were on the side of, because during World War II, about half of the, you know, nationalist forces sided with the with Hitler, and those forces had their own flag, and that's the flag, like a Nazi flag, that's embedded as a symbol in the Croatian flag. You know, that
they destroyed Yugoslavia, as we've talked about, you know, as Michael Parenti wrote about in his book about To Kill a Nation. I try to emphasize over and over when I talk to people about imperialism, about U.S. imperialism, the right. United States Empire, the U.S. Empire, is the largest empire to ever exist in human history, and it's the most powerful empire to ever exist in human history. And that's why I call I tend to call the U.S. president.
Hello?
Can you hear me?
I think we lost Christopher here.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Oh, okay. I tend to call the U.S. President the global emperor, because that's what he really is. That's what he functions as. He's a kind of a dictator, an imperial dictator, and that's what the American ruling class chooses once every 4 years. A new emperor.
Yeah, and the American people, I think, have to wake up and start connecting these dots to the economic system, because these represent the underlying priorities of capitalism. Imperialism is the highest stage of capitalism. It is capitalism, and it's necessary for capitalism to continue to grow at the expense of all of the American workers, because as imperialism advances, so does poverty. That they go hand in hand, and it's about bringing American workers and workers abroad further into the abyss to continue to assert power and control, and control the world's resources. And it's just a complete mess. So this is our job is to educate people about imperialism, because you don't hear that word at all in the Western media.
No.
When do you hear the word imperialism? Never.
Not very often.
No, it's taboo. If Bernie Sanders, I haven't heard Bernie Sanders talk about U.S. imperialism, because he knows
because he is a U.S. imperialist, he supports all the U.S. imperialism.
Exactly.
You know, great point that Parenti made today in the speeches I was watching, he says we think of these poverty-stricken countries in Africa and South America and Asia as being underdeveloped. He says no, they're not underdeveloped. They're overexploited. You know,
yeah.
These are rich countries, he says. They don't go after poor countries to exploit them. They go after rich countries in Africa where they're, you know, the whole continent is extremely rich in resources.
Right.
Same thing in the Middle East. They go after rich countries like Iraq, tremendously rich. Rich enough to make all its, you know, allow all its people to live like kings before Bush et al. Destroyed them in 2003. These are rich countries, and we've been taught to think of them as poor countries, as
right.
underdeveloped. That's the word
yeah.
they use, underdeveloped. You know,
exactly.
No, they're not underdeveloped. They're overexploited. I think that was such a great line by Parenti. They're overexploited, rich countries, you know, that are being thieved from, that are being stolen from. That's the way imperialists roll. That's the way they operate, you know. And you look at, and the other point that he made, he said, capitalism, people think the capitalist ideologues try to tell you that capitalism makes everybody richer, it lifts all boats. You look around the world, as capitalism has spread around the world, so too has poverty increased in the world and all those areas where capitalism goes. I mean, I look at Eastern Europe today. Eastern Europe is pretty much a basket case, and it wasn't that way 25 years ago before those countries, back when those countries used to be socialist countries, they had a pretty good life. You know, they had free education, free
medical care, free elder care. So we can go down the list, and now it's like all those countries in Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary, Romania, Czech and Slovakia and so forth, Yugoslavia certainly, they all live wretched lives, most of the working class people. Capitalism has created disaster areas in those countries, and the United States has looted those countries.
Well, the thing about this is that capitalism is sacrosanct here in the United States, is that there is no competing economic system whatsoever. It's capitalism. And I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Bob Avakian, but Bob Avakian is a longtime communist. He's a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party. I believe he's one of the founders.
He's the leader of.
And he does a lot of a lot of speeches sometimes in the United States. He teams up with some pretty revolutionary figures to advance a scientific analysis of communism. Why did communism fail? From a scientific approach. And I may not agree with communism. We've talked about the different economic systems, but you know what? We need to get away from this anti-communist natural attitude that even people like Noam Chomsky have in so-called revolutionary media circles here in the United States, because we need a competing economic system. We need a departure from capitalism to avoid the poverty that we speak of. And the reason why, you mentioned a rising tides lift all boats, that is obviously one of the arguments made to maintain capitalism and maintain the status quo, but we don't have a competing economic system, and as a result, the working class in America, just America alone, is completely under siege. And I got to tell you, I'm in Colorado, and I'm talking to people that I'm working with, and you know what? They are in the same position I am, not able to really have a steady employment, not having an increase in their wages. Their productivity is going up. They're one bankruptcy or their one medical situation away from bankruptcy. They don't have enough savings. And this is the new normal of capitalism, because they control their arena of debate. They control everything. And so, to me, it's just becoming more and more clear. We have to start to welcome communist individuals, communist organizations out there, away from elections, as a way to take control of the economic system.
Yeah, well, that's why I like Michael Parenti so much, and really advise people to really start getting into him. I mean, I've been slow to come to his work because I first got interested in him because I'm interested in Marxist analysis of ancient societies, and he did that great book about the assassination of Julius Caesar in 2003. After I read that and saw what a phenomenal book it was, I started reading some of his other books, and I'm going to get into reading more. But he makes the point, and it's maybe I just like him because he makes a lot of points that I've made over the years. But I've told people often that we should look at socialism and the history of socialism as basically as trial and error. We tried things out, some things worked. We got some bad people in there that didn't do the right thing, that weren't really objectively working for the best for the working class. And we should look at those experiments and look not just at the bad, because that's all we hear about. All we hear about the former Soviet Union and the former Yugoslavia and the former,
right.
you know, Poland and all of the rest of Eastern Europe, East Germany, and so forth. All we hear is the bad, and there
right.
was certainly bad. I mean, there were
right.
there were bad aspects of that, but you know, they had great societies in a lot of ways.
Right.
Aspects of their societies, you know, you look at the East Germans, for instance, they had social benefits that I think any normal working class person would love to have. And you talk to a lot of the people who grew up in Eastern Europe, in Eastern European countries or in the Soviet Union,
right.
and a lot of them say, yeah, I wish it was back. You know, I think that there's something like 70% of the people that in Russia say that it was a terrible mistake to bring about the end of the Soviet Union, and that they wish the Soviet Union were back, and they wish they lived in that society because there was a hell of a lot good about it, and there was a hell of a lot. Even though, you know, the workers' states of those countries was, to use Trotsky's term, they were kind of deformed in certain ways. They weren't totally democratic, and they should, you know, we do need, you know, to follow the example, say, of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and create a democratic form of real socialism. But,
well, you know, my...
You know, there were a lot of good stuff that we should also look at, too. And, you know, it's basically keep the good stuff and throw the bad stuff out. That's what I say.
And Michael Parente writes about this, how there was no free market paradise after the collapse of communism in Russia or in the Soviet Union. And so,
right.
And he, you know, he goes over the statistics and everything, and the a lot of countries that had seen similar types of interventions on the part of unelected capitalist coups that were supported by the United States and all the brutality, the statistics are pretty much the same. It's the same here in the United States, but again, you know, they have gained consent. They have manufactured consent, to use Noam Chomsky's phrase, because of the institutions they control and because of the social order itself. And that's why, you know, you talk about communism, you talk about socialism, and you can't even get through the filtering system in the corporate media because of these issues, because... You know, that's the one thing you can't challenge in any meaningful way. I mean, we're doing it. We do it every week here on the show.
Well,
and
you don't
see it
you don't see it in the mass media. But despite that, the amazing thing is that more than a third of Americans now lean towards socialism, and they like socialism better than capitalism, and that's almost 50% among the youth. So somehow, even through the thick haze of all the lies that these capitalist pigs and their bought and paid for media services tell us, people, it's getting through, you know. And I
well,
think
you know,
I believe, especially since 2008, since you know, since the crash of the world economy, you know. So talking about socialism is no longer a taboo in America. And, you know, that's why someone like Bernie Sanders, who's not a real socialist but calls himself a socialist, can make the inroads that he's made even in the Democratic Party because, you know, the taboo has broken and despite all the best efforts of the right wing to demonize that word.
Yeah, well, you know what? And another thing we have to drive home, I want to welcome the people in the chat room. We have a few people in the chat room, one of whom, Bubba from the Backwoods Show, is making some lewd comments here. Not surprising. He said, and food stamps,
good for
too.
You, Bubba.
He has one eye and no mouth, needs little food. See, he has no arms and legs, too, just bald and ugly. I don't know who he's talking about there. But we also welcome Flycatch, too, and another person in the chat room. But, you know, one thing that we have to drive home for people is that electing the people that we talk about, the socialists or communists, electing them to office is not going to change the dynamics. It's not going to do anything. And so that's what our job is, to get people to move beyond elections. Elections don't matter. No matter who wins, the working class loses. And you can look at Syriza, the recent capitulation of Syriza in Greece and Alex Tsipras, and just understand that if we're going to topple the system, we all have to be unified. You know, Flycatch, who's in our chat room, he's a Tea Party, pretty right-wing individual. We welcome that. And I got to hand it to the Tea Party, and this is a point that Alan Moss makes, is that they're not a single-issue entity or group. I don't know to the extent that they exist anymore. I think the capitalist establishment that controls the Republican Party has really obliterated the Tea Party. But to the extent that they do exist, they hate government. They hate minorities. They hate. They hate Islam. They hate anything that's not white in America. And we have to really get people, as is the case with the working class, to hate capitalism, to really, really, really think beyond the box. And I go back to the Russian Revolution when Vladimir Lenin was recruiting the Bolsheviks. He recruited those that really hated the system the most, that were most affected by the system. So that's an important point. And Flycatch posts something, just who is going to pay for all those on welfare in your society. I will say this, Flycatch, the amount of people on welfare is not as much as you think. Actually, 50% of people that are on welfare are working individuals. They have a job, they just don't make enough money to pay the bills. And also, the amount of welfare recipients, the amount of money that we spend on welfare is less than 10% of the budget. I will say, if you think that the capitalist government is interested in spending money on welfare programs as opposed to what we've been talking about, you know, imperialist programs or imperialism, tax breaks for the very wealthy, corporate welfare, you're just out of your mind. You know, Fred Goldstein of the Workers' World Party says it best: in a time of crisis, when it comes down to social spending and the capitalists maintaining their share of the budget, there's no match. There's just absolutely no match.
Yeah.
Social spending.
Well, there's this thing going. There's this chart going around, and it shows for a person making $50,000 a year, how much of your paycheck that's going towards taxes, how much are you paying each year for different items in the government budget, and welfare to corporations and welfare to the rich and the super rich is $4,000 out of that. Money that you're paying for food stamps is $36.
I think for
what people think of as welfare, which is basically women with a couple of children who don't have a job, but of course they're made to go on like workfare kind of things.
Exactly.
That's about 130, 140 out of it. So it doesn't compare to the welfare to the rich. $4,000 for a person making $50,000 a year. You know?
I know.
Mean, that's the thing, that these people like, what's his name, Flycatch?
Yep.
They won't ever hear that. They won't ever hear the truth about how much welfare to the rich we're paying each year as compared to how much welfare to your fellow workers who have run on hard times or are disabled or whatever. You know, you don't hear those statistics because it's too embarrassing for the capitalists to admit how much welfare they get, the rich get, who don't need it.
You know, and it's because it's not up for debate. It's not visible.
Right.
The reason why there's such agitation towards things like welfare, you know, going back to dog whistle politics, which really began under Nixon and was mastered by Ronald Reagan, is because when people and Tea Party people think that they're voting against the government, they're really voting against the minority, who they've been told really represents the problems. All that ails society. Well, let me tell you, it wasn't the minority community that crashed the economy in 2008 and that forced trillions and trillions of dollars in welfare money to banks, bailout money. That could you imagine us spending trillions of dollars bailing
reverse,
out?
It's reverse Robin Hood. It's robbing from everybody else, from the poor, the working class, and the middle class to pay the rich.
Exactly.
Trillions of dollars, as you said. I mean, I saw an estimate, something like $17 trillion was transferred, not just through direct government bailout of banks, but also through the Fed, through the Federal Reserve System, pumping money, you know, into these failing banks that should have been, should have been nationalized. In a rational country that would have been nationalized, because obviously capitalism doesn't work. You know, that's the bottom line there that we should pound home. Capitalism doesn't work. And those banks, those too big to fail banks, they prove that capitalist banks don't work.
We got about 4 minutes left here on the show. Our good friend Flycatch says, by 2020, the whites in America will be the minority, and who will be left to pay for all the social programs? Well,
again, he's worried about the pennies, and he's not worried about the, you know, thousands of dollars that they're stealing from his paycheck to pay the rich, to pay the big corporations.
Let me tell you something, Flycatch, too. Let's just talk about the immigrants, the Mexican workers that have been displaced and have come to the United States. Well, you know that there's something called the illegal surplus, okay? And what happens is these workers, I don't like to call them illegal immigrants. I like to call them workers. They come to the United States, and they pay taxes. They pay Social Security taxes without ever claiming Social Security benefits to a large extent. And we're talking about $80 billion a year. I mean, this is going back 5 years. It's probably more by now that they contribute to the Social Security system, which they don't draw from. And then you look at the amount of businesses, almost $1 trillion each year from immigrant-owned businesses. They pay so much more in taxes than they suck up in government services. But again, in hard economic times, it's easy to racism is the boss's tool, and that's what we're seeing right now. It's unbelievable. You need to look upwards. You don't need to look at the welfare queen. Oh, this person's working, so I don't. No, you know what? Mitt Romney is not paying taxes, so you do. This millionaire, this billionaire, they're exploiting your labor. There could be no Walmart without millions of impoverished workers. There could be no Donald Trump without thousands of bankrupt casino employees and so on and so forth. You know, so all right, we got about 2 minutes left, so Christopher, so I'll kind of give you the floor. But this has been a real fun show.
Yeah, well, we did all right without a guest today. You know, one thing I wanted to mention, I listened to the show last week. I listened to it again earlier today. And I was really, I think, impressed by the discussion that went on then. Having Harry on the show really added a lot. And you know what? There were a lot of issues that were brought up that I think we should take the time to delve further into. That would be really beneficial for us to delve further into. So I'm hoping we can get our good old friend Harry on the show again sometime soon.
We absolutely can.
And delve a little bit further into some of these issues that we just kind of touched on, skirted past. So.
Well, Harry's always accessible, so we can get him pretty much any time. I'm really, really happy about that. And the show did very, very well, and so we'll have to have him on the show again. But I just want to tell everybody that you can visit our website at electionboycott.weebly.com. You can also join us on Facebook. Just type in the Election Boycott Advocates. And make sure to participate in the discussion when you can. As Pinko the Bear always says, pitch in where you fit in. And that's what we're doing here on this show and on Facebook and on the website as well. Join the Election Boycott Advocates. Spread the word. Spread noncompliance, ladies and gentlemen. Christopher, thanks a lot for joining us. Really, really appreciate it. And let's do this again next Thursday.
Yes. Thank you so much, Bob.
Take care, my friend.
Bye-bye.
And thanks to all that